The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. I'm Shara Polly, and I'm so pleased to welcome you to, I can't believe I'm saying this, the second virtual Pickwick Salon. Hopefully by the next year, we will be able to have this event in person and be able to see all of you again. This is actually one of my favorite annual events because it gives us an opportunity to say thank you to the members of our Pepper Society for their most generous support of the Free Library and its vital programming and services. Ever since its inception in the early 90s, the Pepper Society has grown annually. It transitioned from a recognition society to a membership program several years ago, and we currently have more than 400 households and individuals who enjoy the benefits of belonging to the Peppers as they generously support the Free Library's programs. This past year, I don't have to tell you, has challenged all of us in ways that we could not have expected, but your continued membership during this time has meant so much to us. It's been difficult to express the depth of our appreciation over the past months in this distanced and virtual environment. I really hope you all know how much you mean to us, and that this evening is in some small way a demonstration of our commitment to you, our Pepper members. So thank you for being with us this evening. I am humbled to be on the same virtual stage with our guests this evening. And we're going to begin with an introduction by Leslie Walker, our interim director of the library, my friend and colleague. And Leslie, thank you. I turn the mic over to you.
Thank you so much, Shara. I appreciate that. Good evening and welcome. I'm so pleased to have this opportunity to greet you all in my capacity as interim director of the Free Library. This event tonight, the annual Pickwick Salon, is created especially for you, members of the George S. Pepper Society, our closest friends and supporters, to recognize and thank you for all that you do to enable our work. Your belief in our mission and your understanding of the value we offer to patrons of all ages in every neighborhood of the city, as well as virtually now from far and wide, continues to energize us all. And while this has been a year of significant challenges for the library, it has also presented us with so many opportunities that have demonstrated just how creative and flexible we are in the face of adversity. In April alone, we processed 2,657 library cards, presented 1,216 virtual programs that drew in 38,095 viewers, circulated almost 185,000 electronic materials, including ebooks, audiobooks, movies, and music. And we saw similar results in prior months. I hope that many of you participated in the One Book, One Philadelphia programming around this year's selection, The Tradition by Jericho Brown. The finale last night was a fitting ending to this year's exceptional 19th season. We are so grateful to the Field Foundation, the Linfest Foundation, PICO, the Calders Foundation, and the Philadelphia Cultural Fund for their generous support of this impactful citywide programming. Perhaps you join the many others who enjoyed watching Trust No One, The Politics of Fear, the five-part series that explored the life of former Senator Joseph McCarthy and the dangerous legacy he left. And our ongoing series, Hear Me Out, invites individuals in urban and rural communities across Pennsylvania to discuss contemporary issues as a way to build trust and collectively understand experiences that lay the foundation for collective civic action. We thank the Horace Goldsmith Foundation for its support of Hear Me Out. The library's exceptional programming and services are made possible by your membership support, and for that, I extend heartfelt thanks on behalf of the entire library staff. I hope that I will have an opportunity soon to thank you in person when it is safe to reopen our doors and invite you to return. And now I have the great pleasure of introducing tonight's speakers for this special event in appreciation of the George S. Pepper Society. We'll hear Professor Carol Anderson, author of the National Book Critics Circle Award winner, White Rage, in conversation with Tracy Matisak, award-winning journalist and broadcaster, about her most recent work, The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. Ladies, the screen is yours now.
Thank you so much, Leslie and Professor Anderson. Welcome back to the Free Library of Philadelphia. We are delighted that you're here to talk with us about your newest book.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Well, we have a lot of ground to cover, so I'll start at the beginning, where you begin with a story of Philando Castile as an example of how the Second Amendment has failed Black people. Remind us of what happened in that case.
So Philando Castile was a Black man and in Minnesota, and the police had pulled him over. And when the police officer asked to see ID, Philando Castile, following NRA guidelines, alerted the officer that he had a license to carry weapon with him, but that he was reaching for his ID as the officer had asked. And from that, the officer began shooting and killed Philando Castile. We saw the video images, this broadcast. He was killed because he had a gun. Not that he was brandishing a weapon, not that he was threatening anyone, simply because he had a licensed weapon. I was stunned about the virtual silence of the NRA in that, because this is the NRA that is the champion of the Second Amendment. This is the NRA that called after Ruby Ridge and after Waco, called federal officers jackbooted government thugs for killing law-abiding citizens and breaking into their homes and taking their weapons. And these were actually folks who had shot at federal officers and killed some. But you get virtual silence from the NRA at this. And journalists began asking, well, do African Americans have Second Amendment rights? And I went, wow, that is a great question. And that's what got me started on this hunt.
So on the back cover of the book says the Second Amendment isn't about guns, it is about anti-Blackness. And then you go back 400 years to begin to make your case for that argument. And I do want to rewind from the Philando Castile story and go back to the 1600s, because you say that there were deliberate legislative efforts in the North as well as in the South to make sure that Black people, enslaved or free, did not have access to guns. What was that all about?
And so when I mean by anti-Blackness, it is the fear coursing through American society that defines Black people as dangerous, as a threat, as an entity that needs to be contained and subjugated. And so we see this in the legislation coming out barring Black people from being able to have access to guns. We see it in the South, where you have massive slavery, but we also see it in the North, where you have slavery as well, which is one of the things that we really don't understand, is that the colonies had slavery in New York, in Connecticut, in Rhode Island, in Massachusetts, slavery. And you had legislation, for instance, barring Black people from joining the militia in the North, because there was the fear of Black people with guns, and this is in the 1600s. You have the legislation coming in the South about Black people cannot have access to guns, and this is because of the massive fear of slave revolts, that there will be retribution, that if they get their hands on weapons, they will kill us. And so you get this legislation, and so with each revolt, with each rumor of a revolt, you start getting the architecture of control being put in place. These laws, but also slave patrols that go into slave cabins and monitor and looking for contraband and monitor the movements of the enslaved people, but also the militia. And the militia are there to control, to put down slave revolts.
I want to talk about the militia, because the militia was supposed to have a number of different purposes, including repelling a foreign invasion and so forth. But you make the case that it wasn't really about that, that the purpose of the militia was much more about slavery.
Yes. And so the militia's role, today we get this narrative of the militia as this heroic force that repelled the British and fought for American liberty and freedom and justice. But during the War for Independence, the militia, sometimes they show up, sometimes they wouldn't. Sometimes they fight, sometimes they wouldn't. Sometimes they take off running. George Washington was beside himself at the unreliability of the militia in terms of fending off a professional army. And you had Governor Morris out of New York saying that to rely upon the militia to fend off a foreign invasion is like depending upon a broken reed. They knew that the militia could not do this work. They had proven it repeatedly. We also get this issue of the militia as this force for domestic tyranny, fending off domestic tyranny. But we had Shays' Rebellion right before the Constitutional Convention. And Shays' Rebellion, where we're in a group of white men in Massachusetts, were angry about taxation policy and the foreclosure of land, the seizure of land for non-payment of taxes. So they attacked the Massachusetts government. And they were on their way to the armory. Massachusetts tries to call out the militia to control Shays' Rebellion. The militia were like, no, I'm not feeling that. And then there were members of the militia actually joined Shays' Rebellion. And so it required Boston merchants to fund a mercenary army to put down Shays' Rebellion. So the reliability of the militia was really in doubt. What the militia could really do consistently was to put down slave revolts. Yeah. That was a key function for the militia.
Well, and that's also interesting, because when you think about the Revolutionary War, and you write about this in the book, that the fact was there were not enough white men to really fend off the British. And there was talk about arming, you know, Black people to be part of the revolutionary force, the Continental Army. But there was a lot of resistance to that, in spite of the fact that the militias were thin, unreliable, and not really an entity that could be depended upon.
Right, absolutely. And so in 1775, basically Black men had been banned from the Continental Army. But the exigencies of war and the lack of white men willing to enlist in the Continental Army finally compelled the states to begin to enlist Black people. And one of the things you saw happening in the North was offering emancipation for those enslaved men who would fight for the patriots, who would fight for the rebels. You will get your freedom if you fight for us. And part of what was the tripwire for that is that the Earl of Dunmore down in Virginia had offered freedom to the enslaved of the rebels if they would come fight for the King of England, that you will get your freedom. And so you start seeing this mass movement of Black folks fighting for the British, which is swelling their ranks. And you get the Continental Army going, oh, we got to do something here. We got to do something. But when the war, and so with the Continental Army, the enlistment of Black folks made that a truly integrated fighting force. And when they were a truly integrated fighting force, their resiliency stiffened, and it moved the British, it compelled the British to go south and hit what they called the soft underbelly. When they hit the soft underbelly, they took Georgia like that. Then they were headed to Charleston to take South Carolina. George Washington sends his emissary down there, John Lawrence, a son of the South, son of South Carolina, and says, look, you only have 750 white men who are eligible to fight, because South Carolina had deployed the rest of its white men as part of the militia to keep that enslaved population down. And Lauren said, you got to arm the enslaved. There are 8,000 British troops coming. You only have 750 white men. That's a problem. And South Carolina said, no, the problem is you asking us to arm the enslaved. We are horrified. We don't even know if this is a nation worth fighting for. We would rather take our chances with the British than arm the enslaved.
You know, I was struck by the fact as I read the book, how you talked about that both in the Constitutional Convention and sort of the run-up to that, as well as 70 plus years later, the run-up to the Civil War, that really what it amounted to was that slavery was the price of unity. It was the price that was paid in both wars to kind of keep everybody together.
Yes. Yes. I mean, so one of the things that you see is with the Constitutional Convention, you have the South that wants to embed slavery, to protect slavery, strengthen the institution of slavery in the United States. And you have these Northern delegates, many of these Northern delegates who want a stronger United States of America because the Articles of Confederation just weren't working. But the South was playing basically a game of chicken, a game of hardball. And I'm mixing metaphors here, but basically saying, if we don't get what we want in terms of protecting slavery, then we will walk. You will not have a United States of America. And the other delegates were so afraid of that, that we ended up with the three-fifths clause in the Constitution. We ended up with an expansion of 20 years on the Atlantic slave trade in the Constitution. And we ended up with the Fugitive Slave Clause in the Constitution as the price of, as the price for the South to sign on to the Constitution of the United States so that there would really be a viable United States. But what happens that gets us to the Second Amendment is that you have in the Constitutional Ratification Conventions, it's being ratified, and then it stalls. And so Virginia is sitting there as one of the biggies that has not ratified yet. And Patrick Henry, war hero, revolutionary, right, is arguing big time that because James Madison had put control of the militia under the federal government in the Constitution, that slaveholders would be left defenseless if there was an uprising. He's like, you cannot trust the North. You know, the North detests slavery. George Mason is like, we will be left defenseless. They won't send the militia down here to protect us. They hate slavery. We will be slaughtered. We can't have this. And so they started pushing hard on Madison, basically threatening the Constitution of the United States, saying we will have a new constitutional convention if we don't get a Bill of Rights that protects us. And that Bill of Rights, so when you think about our Bill of Rights, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, the right not to be illegally searched and seized, the right to a speedy and fair trial, the right not to have cruel and unusual punishment, the rights for a well-regulated militia, for the security of the state, the right of the people to bear arms shall not be infringed. I mean, it is just, it is such an outlier. It is the same kind of outlier as the three-fifths clause because it is the bribe to the South to not scuttle the United States of America.
So the second was passed in 1791, end of the year, and it's just before that time that the Haitian Revolution takes place. How does that impact the conversation about slavery in this country?
Oh, the Haitian Revolution sent shockwaves through the United States, particularly in the slaveholding South. What they saw were that Black people were more than willing to rise up. They were more than willing to fight for their freedom, and they were more than willing. They had defeated the Spanish, they had defeated the British, and they had defeated the French. And that, when you take on three of the major European armies with massive guerrilla warfare, the fact that they were successful in defeating them, the fact that they were articulating a revolutionary ideology that had that was similar in so many ways to the ideology of the American Revolution and the French Revolution, which the colonists believed had a whites only sign on it. So that these Black people were talking about freedom and justice and democracy and the right of a people to govern themselves was just anathema, and that they were willing to fight for it. They were afraid that that toxin would come into the Black population here in America and lead to this revolutionary fervor. And so you see, and one of the things that happened right after that, you had Gabriel's uprising, Gabriel's rebellion in Virginia in 1800. And Gabriel's rebellion was widespread over multiple cities, multiple counties. And Governor James Monroe found out about it like the night before it was supposed to happen. And shockwaves, I mean, terror. And that Gabriel articulated a vision of a multiracial, multi-ethnic republic where you got paid for your labor was just frightening, frightening. And you saw in Maryland as the folks are fleeing from Saint-Domingue, from Haiti, that as they're bringing their enslaved with them, whites in Maryland were petrified, and the government opened up the public armory so that whites could arm themselves against these Haitians who were coming in to the state.
Wow. I want to take a moment and just remind our audience that if you've got questions for Professor Anderson, you'll see at the bottom of your screen there is a little Q&A icon. If you click on that, you can enter your question there, and we've saved some time at the end of the program, so we'll get through as many of those as we can. But meantime, Professor Anderson, I've got lots of questions for you. One is this, and it was not long after the time period that you're talking about, like 1811, 1812. I was fascinated to read about the Black militia in Louisiana that you said was extremely well-trained. They were called upon to put down slave uprisings. They were called upon in the War of 1812. I'm curious, who were these men? How is it that they came to be so well-trained, especially in light of the oppressive environment that they were in? How were they able to perform at such a high level?
They had been together since the early 1700s as a fighting unit. They had come together when Louisiana was under Spanish control and then under French control. And so they had more freedoms, more freedom to train, more freedom arm, more freedom to be. And then the Americans bought Louisiana. And with that, all of that training became very fear-inducing for the white population. And so one of the things you saw from whites in New Orleans, the council there, was to demand the disarmament and the disbanding of this Black militia. But the governor looked and he said, these are the only folks who can fight. And we got a lot of stuff we need to fight here. So I don't know how to do this. I mean, it is like, it's like crazy to do this. And so what he tried to do was to square the circle, which was to keep that Black militia in place, but to remove its officer class and put white officers in charge, hoping that that would quell the fear of whites about this really well-trained Black force. But that fear never abated, regardless of how well they performed in putting down the slave revolt in 1811 and in the War of 1812. Instead, the push was on to disarm and disband them, which eventually happened.
I'm curious, what was in it for them to have to go into battle with a white commander and have their officers removed, to go into battle to put down slave uprisings and to kill their own people? What was in it for them?
You know, I think that it was a sense of citizenship, the access to citizenship, that through military work, you gained your citizenship rights, and that's how they saw themselves. And this was a propertied class. To be in this militia, you owned property. And so they also saw the distinction between themselves and the enslaved who were thought of as property. So it was that distinction, but it was that one of the things that we see consistently is the role of military work, being in the militia, being in the armed forces as access to citizenship, access to equality. Mm-hmm. And that just did not happen.
Yeah. I want to fast forward again to after the Civil War, we enter the period of Reconstruction, and now the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments are passed. And in theory, they're designed to protect the freedom and the rights of Black people. But as you write, instead of things getting better, they got markedly worse. And in fact, especially for any Black person who happened to be armed at the time, what were some of the things that were going on?
Oh, you had... These you had the Black codes coming through that were passed by these neo-Confederate governments because President Andrew Johnson had basically issued a mass amnesty for the former Confederate leaders who retook control of their governments. Mm-hmm. And they passed these Black codes that not only were about controlling Black labor, but also about disarming Black people because Black folks were armed from the Civil War. And so it was about disarming them. And it was about the rise of these white domestic terrorists and these paramilitary groups who were like arms of these governments who were going around slaughtering Black folks to put Black people back in their place. And Annette Gordon Reed, historian, called it a slow motion genocide, is what was happening in the South. And you had Andrew Johnson remove Black troops from the South as an occupying force because white Southerners were saying, oh, that the Black troops were the reason for the violence. It was because it was just so hard for them to accept that there were these Black people in uniforms who were marching and parading in their states, in their counties. It just was horrifying. If you would just remove the troops, then peace will be had. But peace was not had. Instead, slaughter happened. So the slaughter was so intense that it led President Ulysses S. Grant, after the Colfax, Louisiana massacre and after the Hamburg massacre in South Carolina, to say, you know what these states all have in common? It isn't Christianity. It isn't civilization. It is the right to kill Negroes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned the Colfax courthouse situation. And I'd love if you would just very briefly, because I have lots of questions, but that's such an important story. Could you share that with us?
Yes. And so there was an election in Louisiana, and the Democrats, who were the party of the white supremacists, the right wing, were just angry at the results of this because Republicans were elected. And so they decided to overthrow the government. They decided to storm the courthouse, the seat of democracy in Colfax, Louisiana. And so the Black militia was called out to protect this seat of democracy and protect the results of the election. But they didn't have enough arms, they didn't have enough ammunition, and they were overwhelmed by this mass force of white supremacists, this paramilitary group who just slaughtered them. They set the courthouse on fire where the Black militia were. As they were running out, and some were surrendering, they were executed, they were tortured. Over 100 were killed at Colfax.
So you have a contested election, you have an attempted insurrection. It sounds like there are some parallels to January 6th.
Right, and what struck me was that the federal government sent charged 8 of the members of the Colfax massacre with violating the Third Enforcement Act, which was about this stopping domestic terrorism of the Klan. The U.S. Supreme Court in the Cruikshank decision ruled that. The four enforcement acts only apply to state actors, so, and not to these private organizations like the Klan. So this massacre, those men walked. They walked for slaughtering over 100 Black men.
So you mentioned groups like the Klan beginning to take shape, particularly as we move out of Reconstruction into the Jim Crow period. And we begin to see race riots popping up all across the country, including, of course, Tulsa, which we just observed the 100th anniversary of last week. But Black people took up arms, as they did in Tulsa, to defend themselves, but paid a heavy price for that.
Oh, absolutely. And this is one of the things that I'm tracking, as you can see in this book, is how when Black folks, the right to self-defense, which we see as just being natural in a bedrock foundational principle of the Second Amendment, Black people do not have the right to self-defense. So in Elaine, Arkansas, where you had Black sharecroppers who had their wages stolen by the planters. So you work for a year and you don't get paid. And so they began to organize with a labor union to really begin to get paid for their work. They knew that, as they said, whites will kill us if they find out. And so they had stationed sentries outside the church where they were organizing, where they were meeting, so that the sentries could be on guard. Well, they noticed that a car had come surveilling what they were doing, and the planters had actually sent a group of folks there to, as they said, break up and shoot up that meeting. There was an exchange of gunfire. A white man was killed and a white man was wounded. When word got back to the town, the word came out that these were these Black insurgents who were going to kill every white person in Elaine. So the mobs descended on that Black community. Mobs coming in from Arkansas and across the border from Mississippi. And as Black people are trying to defend themselves from this mob, two more white men get killed. Then the governor brings in the US Army with an array of machine guns that had been used in the war in France. And they begin machine gunning down Black people, moving from field to field, just clear cutting. And the governor is reveling in this carnage. No white person was ever indicted for the killings, for the mob killings. Up to 800 or so Black people were killed in Elaine, Arkansas. And the message was clear. You do not have the right to self-defense. You do not have the right to the wages of your own labor. We will put you back in your place, which was one of the key messages of Red Summer coming out of World War I, the war to make the world safe for democracy. And they were like, no, that democracy does not apply to you.
Yeah. And Red Summer, red being the blood that was flowing throughout all of these riots and the violence that was taking place across the country.
Yes.
As we moved into the civil rights movement of the 50s and the 60s, certainly there was landmark legislation, again, designed to enhance and protect the rights of Black people. But when it came to guns, not so much.
Not so much. And that's why I pick up the story in the 60s with the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. What was happening in California is you had massive police brutality, killings, beatings, and there was no accountability in the system. And so from that, the Black Panther Party arose with Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale as its co-founders. One of their key elements was to police the police. They knew that California had open carry laws. Huey Newton was a law student. He knew what those laws were. He knew the kinds of guns they could carry. He knew how to carry them. He knew the distance that they had to maintain from police officers making an arrest by California statute, but they were standing there with their guns, policing the police. The police did not like that at all. And when they would try to arrest the Panthers, they couldn't get them on anything because the Panthers weren't doing anything illegal. Mm-hmm. And so they ran to Assemblyman Don Mulford and said, can you help us here? And so Mulford, with the help of the NRA, begins drafting legislation to ban open carry and targeted, you know, and this was targeted at the Panthers. Mulford said it wasn't in his public pronouncements, but when you look at the letters, the Panthers are all over as the catalyst for this? How do we make what they are doing illegal? How do we make the Panthers illegal?
And really interesting that the NRA was involved in that sort of legislation, which is not what we would normally associate with the NRA.
Right, yeah. Right.
You write about what came to be called the Southern Strategy in the late 60s. And the idea essentially was that it painted white citizens as law-abiding people and Black people as lawless. I'm wondering if you can talk about sort of the modern day iteration of that strategy and what you describe as the thugification of Black victims of violence.
In Stand Your Ground, we see it with Stand Your Ground, for instance, with Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman. So the sense that Black people are threats, are inherently dangerous, that they have to be controlled and subjugated by whites. It came from the 17th century, and we're dealing with it when you think about in the 21st century. You have a Black teenager, Trayvon Martin, who's going to a convenience store to get Skittles and iced tea during the break of the NBA All-Star game. George Zimmerman rolls up, and he's as the neighborhood watch captain, and he sees this Black teenager, and he starts calling into 911 that something's not right. This guy looks really suspicious. He's on drugs or something. And these kind, they always get away. And so he grabs his 9mm, loaded 9mm, gets out of his car, out of his SUV, to go stalk Trayvon. The 911 operator says, "Sir, are you following him?" And he says, "Yep." And she's like, "You really needn't ought to do that." And he keeps on doing that. What we know is that Trayvon ended up with a bullet in his chest. So when you look at it on its surface, what you have is a grown man with a loaded weapon following a teenager, an unarmed teenager, and shooting that teenager in the chest. But what happened was the thugification of Trayvon. He became taller, meaner, heavier, hoodied up, grilled older. Up, right? Older. I mean, he became this big, Black, scary guy. And Zimmerman becomes this fragile, poor man who was overwhelmed by this muscular beast. And he had no other option than to defend himself by shooting Trayvon in the chest and killing him. That is the narrative that we get. And in a current iteration of it, we see it with I juxtapose Kyle Rittenhouse, the 17-year-old who crossed state lines to go into Kenosha, Wisconsin, carrying an illegally acquired AR-15. The police welcome him because this is a protest against the shooting of another Black man. The police welcome him. We really appreciate you guys being here. Want some water? We know it's a hot night. Mm-hmm. Kyle Rittenhouse then goes and he guns down three men, killing two of them, seriously wounding a third. After that, he walks towards police with his hands up as if to surrender. The police don't even recognize, they don't even acknowledge this because he's not a threat. Mm. Now, you juxtapose that to 12-year-old Tamir Rice, who is playing in Cleveland, Ohio, in a park by himself with a toy gun. And granted, the orange tip wasn't on the toy gun to alert that it's a toy, but this is an open carry state. And open carry says, as long as you're not pointing it at anyone, you can have the gun. The police rolled up and within 2 seconds, they shot Tamir Rice dead. They said he was a threat. He was dangerous. We were fearful. So you juxtapose a 12-year-old playing by himself in the park in an open carry state, and you get fearful, 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 threat. You get Kyle Rittenhouse, a 17-year-old who guns down three people, killing two of them. And he gets to go home. And when he gets arrested at his home. And then you get this swirl around him saying, well, you know, he was just part of, he was just doing his Second Amendment duty as part of a well-regulated militia.
Yeah, we were talking before we went live this evening about the history that is contained in this book is the kind of history that most of us never learn in school. I learned so much from reading your book. And I've been thinking about the fact that we've been talking a lot about critical race theory of late, and there's a lot of controversy around that. And I would love to hear your perspective about that as a professor of history, no less, as you're listening to these conversations unfold.
Those conversations are like a bait and switch. It's like the way that you hear socialism, socialized medicine, socialism, socialism. It is a way to take your eye off the target. It's a way for you not to engage critically with what is going on. So socialized medicine, socialism, socialism, socialism is now the new buzzword is now critical race theory. So they're banning critical race theory teaching in K through 12. Critical race theory is for law school. It is a legal theory. It is taught in law school, not K through 12. But what this allows to happen is that anything dealing with race and racism, like talking about slavery, talking about Jim Crow, talking about the impact that it has had upon the development of the United States, now becomes banned because now it's divisive. It is a way to silence historians from doing the real work of history. It is a way to keep our population ignorant of how we got here. And if we don't know how we got here, then we can't figure out why this looks the way that it looks. Yeah. And so we end up making bad policies based on bad history.
Yeah. Before we go to questions from our audience, I've been reflecting on your book, and at times it was quite difficult to read just the incidents of violence, the brutality. And I just wondered for you, as you wrote this book and you wrote White Rage and you wrote about, you know, one man, no vote. I just wondered, because you're so deeply immersed in this material, how do you kind of manage that? You also mentioned that you have two sons, and as a mom of a son, I think about that as well. How do you sort of keep all of this in perspective when you're immersed in such heavy material?
It is hard. It is hard. And this was the hardest book to write because the violence was just unrelenting. And the sophistry used to wash away, to make that violence, that there was no accountability for that violence, no justice for that violence. And in the midst of the pandemic, where African-Americans were disproportionately dying from a pandemic that could have easily been controlled, and in the midst of the uprisings due to the police killings of Breonna Taylor, of George Floyd, and of the mishandling of the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, seeing that kind of violence, just as I'm writing about it, right? You know, I'm writing about the past and I'm talking and I'm in the midst of what is going on right now. It was hard. Lots of Blue Bunny double fudge ice cream.
Oh, that sounds like a good remedy. That'll cure what ails you.
Oh, wow. And being true to myself, because my core is joy. My core is joy. And I wasn't going to let all of this inequity and violence destroy my core. Because my core is joy, my core is also hope. And it was that, it's in that hope, it's in the hope that my work will allow a new conversation to happen about the Second Amendment, that we're not talking pro-guns or anti-guns. What we're talking about are Black people's rights, their humanity. And when we make the conversation about rights, then we're having a very different kind of conversation.
Yeah. Well, let's go to some audience questions. There's one here from Teresa who says, thank you for your book. Would you describe for us the process of how you undertook your research for this book? How did you unearth all the details that you needed?
One was to go to some of the key standard text and to see what the arc of the story was, and then to go after as much as was possible the primary sources. And this was the beauty in the midst of a pandemic of having so much, not everything, but so much online. So that I could get the letters of the founding fathers that they were writing back and forth to each other about Haiti, about the Constitution, about the war. And so it was working my way through. And I've got to say that this was a revelation for me, because I did not know this story. I knew that slavery had played a role in the framing of the Constitution with the 3/5 clause, but I didn't know the story of the Second Amendment until I began this research and saw how central slavery was and the protection of slavery was in the ratification and in pushing James Madison to craft this Bill of Rights. And so the process was revelation. It was primary sources, great secondary sources, getting the arc of the story.
Yeah. Question from Thomas, who says, what changes would you propose for the Second Amendment?
What I would propose actually is that we remove the Second Amendment from its hallowed ground, because right now it has this kind of reverence in American society. I've got my Second Amendment rights. And everybody thinks they know what that is. But if we treat the Second Amendment the way we treat the 3/5 clause, it loses its veneration. And that means then that we're able to have a real conversation about what real security looks like, what real safety looks like, what the access to real rights truly look like.
Yeah. That actually reminds me of a quote from your book that I wrote down here, where you said that the modern day veneration of the Second Amendment, driven by the lobbying efforts of the NRA, is akin to holding the 3/5 clause sacrosanct. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yes. I mean, so it's like, you know, remember the 3/5 clause was when the Southern delegates were pressing on the Northern delegates to have African-Americans, to have the enslaved population counted fully in terms of representation in Congress. And the North pushed back, going, wait a minute, do you count them when you're doing your own state legislatures? Can they vote? I mean, so if they can't do that at the state level, why are we giving them any kind of heft at the national level? And the South said, we get it or we're done. We are done. We walk. And so you've got the language in there that is really just opaque about counting 3/5 of a human being in terms for Southern representation. And that provided an additional 18 or so representatives to the South in Congress that they would not have had without that 3/5 clause. But you got a clause based on inhumanity, on denying Black people their wholeness, their fullness, that they did not have rights. That's how we need to treat the Second Amendment.
There is a question here from Jason who says, could you please comment on the current state and national level legislation that seems designed to curb voting rights?
Ooh, Lord. Okay, so that's this book.
That's a whole other book.
Right? And what we're seeing here is that in 2020, you had massive Black voter turnout, and it flipped key states. The response is not this embrace of this mass voter turnout, this embrace of people being willing to put their lives on the line. We had 11-hour lines here in Georgia during the primaries in the midst of a pandemic. people being willing to stand in line that long. Instead, what you have is this fear that, oh crap, Black people have voted, Hispanic folk have voted, Asian American Pacific Islanders have voted, Native Americans have voted, we gotta stop them. And so you see this looking at the methods that those groups use to access the ballot box and then devising methods to create additional hurdles to those groups to make it much more difficult for them to vote. You also see the twin pincer motion on this, which is to lower the guardrails that were there that prevented Trump from being able to flip the elections, to be able to override the vote counts in these states. So the guardrails that were there, the officials that were there, removing them from power so that they don't have a say in what the certification of election results are. This is dangerous. We are in dangerous territory. And the discussion, we've got legislation at the federal level that can take care of this. H.R. 1, S. 1, the For the People Act, and the John H.R. 4, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. Those two bills can handle this, but we've got some kind of, oh, to the filibuster, which is just a load of doggone hooey. That's the scholarly term, because the filibuster has been used to deny civil rights legislation repeatedly. And that's what it's standing up here now. So we're going to have this arcane Senate rule, or are we going to have democracy? Or are we going to let the American people, American citizens vote? That's where we are.
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to have to all stay on our toes and keep an eye on that. Yes. I want to go back to the second in our remaining few minutes here, because we've talked about the NRA a couple of times, and they have been in a lot of trouble of late, legally as well as financially. And I wonder how you see that turning out. Do you think that the NRA will eventually have to dissolve, or do you think that they'll sort of regroup in a different sort of shape? How do you see that working out?
Well, you know, the effort that they had to declare bankruptcy and move to Texas to get away from the legal troubles that they're having in New York, the judge was like, not today, Satan, not today. I believe that's how the legal opinion wrote. what I see, part of what happened is that it was power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And you had that happen with the NRA. They got so big, so powerful, and so corrupt that it began to eat in on itself. I think that what we're going to see is probably a revised version after that corrupt component is removed. And thinking through how do we, for most of its lifespan, the NRA was really about sportsmanship, folks who like to hunt, and the guns that they had. This movement into the political realm is a relatively new component that really launched in the late 1970s. What may happen is a movement back to the original NRA. Mm.
And I want to end on this question before we say goodnight. And that is, as we're thinking about all of these issues, voter suppression efforts, police brutality, mass shootings on an almost daily basis in this country, just so many troubling things that are happening. And I wonder, you know, sort of related to the other question that I asked you about sort of sitting with all of this information, what do you see as the future for our country? Where do you think that we are headed? And in the midst of all of that, what gives you hope?
What gives me hope is that we have always had folks who would fight for this democracy, who would fight for freedom, who would fight for justice, who would fight for equality. It's what we saw in the 2020 election, where you had massive mobilization, grassroots mobilization, where people understood that we were in an existential crisis in this nation, and how it was important to have leadership that could lead us out of this mess. And they were willing to do the work. I'm seeing that same kind of mobilization right now as democracy hangs in the balance. That's where the hope is that you have more people who want this freedom, more people who want a truly vibrant, multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-religious democracy than you have of that group that is holding on to power by denying American citizens their rights and by the omnipresent threat of violence against American citizens. That assault on the Capitol on January 6th, and the fact that you're not getting the kind of real response that should happen, that's where the danger is. Where the hope is that there are so many people who recognize that danger and who are mobilizing to strengthen democracy.
Yeah. Well, I think that is an appropriate note for us to wrap up our conversation on. Professor Carol Anderson, thank you so much. It has been an absolute delight to talk with you.
Thank you. This has been wonderful. Thank you.
And I want to say a special thanks to all of the team at the Free Library who brought this conversation together. Of course, to Leslie Walker and Shara Pauly, who kicked off our conversation, Andy Cahan, as well as Laura and Jason, the whole team there at the author events in the library. I want to thank all of them for bringing all of us together. Thanks to all of you for joining us tonight, for sharing your evening with us. We hope that you found this to be an enlightening conversation. Stay safe out there, and we'll see you next time. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.